I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We continue this hour talking more about the meeting in the Oval Office that President Donald Trump had with high-level Russian officials and the intelligence information that was passed along to them and how the Russians responded to that via their news media and what President Putin has said that he would be happy to release transcripts of the meeting that took place. This hour, we are going to continue, and we hope to spend a little more time talking about Jim Comey's meeting with Donald Trump. The memo was released. It's hard to keep track of this. It's what, today's Wednesday? Was it yesterday? Or was it Monday? Things are happening so fast every single day. And that was the meeting, of course, that concerned Michael Flynn and the firing of Michael Flynn and Donald Trump asking that he would hope that Jim Comey could let this go. We have two guests this hour. Nahal Tusi joins us at the top of the hour, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. She joined Politico from the Associated Press, where she reported from or served as an editor in New York, Islamabad, Kabul, and London. Was one of the first foreign correspondents to reach Pakistan after the killing of Osama bin Laden. She worked also for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she covered higher education, but also reported from Iraq during the U.S. invasion in 2003. And she has reported, she's been all over the place, from Egypt, Thailand, and Germany. And we thank you very much, Nahal, for being with us. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. I want to start with the president's meeting, series of meetings, his foreign trip that's going to be taking place this Friday. Considering all that's going on in this country, does this give him a break from all the news about Russia and Jim Comey and Michael Flynn, or does he have to be briefed in a special way because he's in some countries where there is a relationship between Israel and some of the news that came out in the last couple of days? Is this a break for him, or does this put him more under a larger spotlight, an international spotlight?
Well, it basically does both. His aides certainly hope that it will be somewhat of a boost for him, especially because he is liked by the Saudi government and the Israeli government. And so they're kind of hoping that it will draw some spotlight away from the Russia-related allegations against him here, as well as the intelligence issues. At the same time, it's a whole new stage on which he might make some gaffes or stumble over some diplomatic protocols. And so there's just a lot of potential danger as well when it comes to this trip.
Mm. I want to go back to this meeting because I don't fully understand what the president was doing. He's got an administration that's under investigation by the House, the Senate, the Treasury Department, the FBI, who knows how many places for possible coordination with the Russians when it came to the election. And yet he has the foreign minister and the ambassador of the United States, while he's under investigation, after he has fired James Comey, director of the FBI, he's doing all of this while this investigation is happening. I just don't understand not only the optics of this, the reasoning on the part of the president to make this front and center when it's already something that's not really looking good for him.
Well, you are not alone. That mystery is definitely something being debated in Washington, especially on Capitol Hill among Republicans who are really getting pretty tired of the scandals that are engulfing this administration. But, you know, Trump does have a stubborn streak. He has for a long time wanted to improve relations with Russia. He has done some things, it's worth saying, you know, that detract from the Russians. I mean, he bombed the Syrian regime after the chemical attack, and that was an example of him basically standing up to Russia, which is the Syrian regime's main outside sponsor. But generally speaking, he has spoken favorably of Vladimir Putin, and so it was very, very, very strange timing for him to have the Russian diplomats in his office just so shortly, especially right after firing Jim Comey. I mean, the timing just was extraordinary, and everybody was very much remarking on it. And then, you know, it might have faded had the revelations about the alleged leaking of classified information not come out. And then that brought even more of a spotlight on that particular meeting. Mm-hmm. It's also worth noting that, you know, American media were not allowed in to any part of that meeting, but the Russian media were. And that was really something that irked a lot of people, because Russian media are effectively controlled by the Kremlin.
Why was that decision made? Do you know?
You know, the White House is never very clear about this, but there is some sense that they probably didn't fully understand that the Russian media that were with the Russian diplomats were basically state media, and that they were going to release the photos that made Trump and the Russian diplomats look so chummy with each other.
Right.
And so, but that just, you know, that just frankly makes the White House look rather foolish, like they didn't really do their research. And it doesn't really give an excuse as to why American media were not allowed in, at least at the beginning, which is what normally happens. You know, the press reporters go in there, they take some photographs, they try to ask a question, and then they're escorted out, and the meeting basically begins privately. But they have not been able to offer a decent explanation.
Mm-hmm. And then if we didn't have American media there, how did we get the information? And I'm glad we did, because we should know these things as American citizens. But how did the information get to the press that classified information was discussed with the Russians?
Well, it appears to be from leaks from people in the intelligence community who were pretty angry about what had happened. The president is alleged to have discussed some sensitive information given to U.S. intelligence by Israel. And in doing so, intelligence officials fear that he may have blown the cover of an important source of information for them in terms of the fight against the Islamic State. So there's just a lot of worry about what he did, what he said, and the kind of repercussions that it could have on Americans' intelligence gathering efforts.
Mm. And also the repercussions it could have on intelligence community giving him briefings about information. They must do that with some serious concern.
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to people in the intel world, they will tell you that, look, these are consummate professionals. Their entire mission is to give the president the best information that he needs to have to make these very tough decisions that he makes on national security. But the issue is that it's possible some of them might say, you know what, maybe when we send this summary along to the White House, we don't need to get into as much detail as we used to get into. So, for instance, maybe we don't need to name the city where this is happening. Maybe mm-hmm. we can just say it's in a particular region. It's that sort of thing. Now, whether it's going to happen, honestly, we may never know. And it might just be like a handful of people as opposed to a systematic issue for U.S. intelligence. But there's no question that the relationship between Trump and the U.S. intelligence community is just very strained.
And I want to talk to you just a little bit about this upcoming foreign trip. The president, I haven't read a lot about this. Maybe you've written about it. The president is giving a speech in Saudi Arabia about Islam. What's he going to talk about?
Yeah, this is something that has come out. We don't exactly know what's going to be in the text. There have been some serious indications, I mean, including from sources that I have, that it's being largely written by Stephen Miller. And Stephen Miller is a Trump aide who has a pretty long track record of being very anti-Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And what's entirely possible, though, is that the speech will focus a lot on fighting against Islamic extremism, that sort of thing. But it's a really tough thing to pull off a speech like that in a place like Saudi Arabia.
I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, frankly, you know, Saudi Arabia is it's Wahhabi philosophy when it comes to Islam. It's Wahhabism, and it's the source of many, many, many of the terrorists who have attacked the United States. And so it's just going to be fascinating to see how far Trump will go, and whether if he goes too far and says something that's, you know, even perceived as insulting by even some people in the Muslim faith, there could be some violence in some corners. Mm. So it's a very tricky line that he's going to have
mm-hmm.
to go.
For the first time, I was watching some cable news last night, and David Gergen was using the word impeachment, that he thought we were entering that territory. Certainly Carl Bernstein has made comparisons to obstruction of justice that was found in Watergate. That's where all the comparisons are coming now, the obstruction of justice. A lot of people are saying that. A few Republicans are talking about an independent investigation. There are some Democrats who have called for impeachment of this president. How deep is the trouble that this president is in?
Honestly, this is the most serious trouble I think he's
really
been in yet. This is something that seems to have some staying power. Republicans in particular are really anxious and alarmed over this. Now, you know, it's possible that this could fade too, the same way that the Access Hollywood tape faded away from the headlines. But this is serious. People, when you have Republicans saying, you know, we want to see the memos and, you know, possibly talking about like a special prosecutor, that sort of thing, it's pretty intense. But I still think it's probably too soon to say that there's definitely going to be an impeachment. I mean, let's not forget, you know, the Republicans are in charge of Congress, and I don't know if they want to take on an impeachment of a president from their own party. At the same time, you know, the thing that really drives Republicans, or any political party for that matter, is the prospect of elections. And so as the midterms come closer, you know, this question of whether you stick with Trump or you break with Trump is going to loom larger and larger, especially if Republicans go home and they have a lot of unhappy constituents.
Well, they know they have some unhappy constituents. Some of those meetings have been pretty wild.
They have been also, although if you talk to some Republicans, they say, look, these are all just staged. There are these, you know, organizations that are bringing these people out.
Right.
So there is this kind of denial, I think, of some of the real outrage that's out there.
And when you look at the two areas of concern, the classified information that was given to the Russians, and when you look at the president asking Comey to kind of drop the investigation of Mike Flynn, is one more serious than the other?
It sounds, I mean, both are pretty serious. I would say that, you know, the classified information thing is probably a little less serious simply because the president does have the authority to basically declassify information when he wants to. So it doesn't look like he may have broken any laws on that particular front. But when it comes to the Comey memo, there are people talking about obstruction of justice, asking, you know, if he went too far. And that could be grounds for the impeachment. I would say the Comey issue is a bit more serious, and it's really, I mean, people at the White House are really freaking out. I mean, when you have so few of them willing to even talk on the record or put their name to anything or go on the TV shows to talk about, to defend the president, it's a really bad sign. I mean, there's talk that maybe some of the White House aides need to get their own lawyers. So.
Mm-hmm. Are you going on this trip with the president?
No, I am not. One of my colleagues, who is a White House reporter, is going on the trip. But I'll be watching it from afar. I've been to some of these countries in the past, and it's just going to be really, really interesting to see how President Trump, who frankly doesn't, you know, he kind of likes to sleep in his own bed. So this the idea of this long trip covering so many different places, it's going to be fascinating to see how he adjusts and what he does on an international stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have been all over the place. Let's take one call for you, Dave in Austin, Texas. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Hello, Dave. Go right ahead. Go ahead, Dave. You're on the air.
Oh, hey. Just two quick things. Just say if Trump were to happen to be impeached, I mean, at least he's saying, I'm not a fan of Pence either, but at least he's competent. And then going on to, I mean, whether or not that happens or not, for the 2020 election, I mean, are they going to, having everything that's going on right now, is there going to be some sort of competency exam for candidates for both parties?
Oh, Dave, you're way ahead of all of us. We're having a hard time keeping up with the day-to-day thing here. No.
Well, you know, I think that President Pence would definitely calm the jitters in much of the Republican Party. I mean, Pence was considered a potential presidential contender well before Trump really hit the scene. Now, Pence is a very, very conservative guy, and so his policies may not necessarily be to the liking of Democrats, but there is even a recognition that he is less unpredictable, or let's just say he's more predictable than Trump, and even people on the liberal side of things may long for a time when things are a bit more boring in Washington under President Mike Pence. Now, as a journalist, I have to admit the Trump presidency is certainly fascinating to cover. I'm not sure a Pence presidency would be as as interesting news-wise. But that being said, you know, maybe I'll get my weekends back. So
yeah, it's exhausting to cover this president, I would think.
I am so tired.
I bet you are. I can see how you would definitely be really tired. The other thing that's pretty remarkable, I was thinking about this last night, the amount of news that's happened in this administration and the fact that people are talking impeachment, and this president is only 4 months in to his first year. That's pretty phenomenal. Things can't continue at this pace, I don't think.
It's really amazing. I mean, you know, you will write a story and the shelf life of the story
yes.
will be so short because something brand new happens a few hours later
mm-hmm.
and it completely, you know, pushes your story out of the spotlight. It's amazing. It's like he's trying to cram 4 years into just 4 months.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's the way of the world. But, you know, he is an outsider. He promised to shake things up in Washington, and he's certainly done that.
Yeah, well, I don't think he thought then his administration was going to be as shaken up as it is at the moment. Nahal, thank you so much for being with us. Join us again, please, sometime.
Happy to do that.
Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. She's traveled all over the world, and she worked for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, covering higher education at one point. We're going to continue. Andrew Kidd will be with us momentarily from UW-Madison, where he's a political science professor who has a specialty in security issues, and we'll talk about those as we carry on our conversation and welcome more of your phone calls, too. I need to tell you how you can get a hold of us. I guess the theme of this hour is what the national security ramifications are to what happened with the meeting and the Russians and the dissemination of classified information. We also are into a heavy political realm here now because there is so much going on in terms of what information will be asked for. The Comey memos, and some are saying there will obviously be more than one memo here, and there will be intelligence committees that will be getting those memos, and I believe that, well, I don't believe it, it is true, that Comey said that he would testify. He wants it to be a public hearing, so I'm sure that that's coming up as well. And what happens in the meantime to the ability to govern because all of this is going on? What do you think? We certainly welcome your thoughts, and here's how you give us those. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we are always happy to read your messages, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Professor Andrew Kidd, our guest, his special areas are international security issues, proliferation, terrorism, trust, and conflict resolution. He is a man who writes a great deal. He's published articles in the American Political Science Review, World Politics, International Security. His book, Trust and Mistrust in International Relations, was published not that long ago. Professor Andrew Kidd, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Things are kind of topsy-turvy, aren't they?
That's one way to put it, yes. Very topsy-turvy, all right. Extremely unprecedented, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at, because your special area is security, when you look at what happened concerning classified information given to the Russians and what happened with Donald Trump, some are saying obstructing justice by asking James Comey to drop this Flynn thing, this Flynn investigation, is one of greater concern to you? Are you more concerned about classified information being given to the Russians?
Well, one is more of a foreign policy issue, and one is more of a domestic politics issue. So on the foreign policy side, the conversation with the Russian ambassador, which relayed some information that had been given to us in confidence by Israel and was viewed to be highly classified, is pretty important because we have a lot of intelligence cooperation with Israel,
mm-hmm.
As we do with other allies. And one question that a lot of countries have now is whether it's reasonable to share intelligence with the United States at this point. Because if things go up to the presidential level, which they tend to do, there's not a lot of confidence that they won't be revealed in a sort of off-the-cuff, unplanned, even random sort of way, because Trump does not seem to share his predecessor's view of the importance of classified information and the seriousness with which people tend to take it. So that could shut down American access to intelligence about threats like the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, other terrorist organizations, their branches and affiliates around the Middle East, and in other countries, which could be extremely detrimental to American counterterrorism efforts. It's an unfortunate aspect of counterterrorism that often the most effective things are essentially invisible to the general public. It's careful, detailed intelligence gathering, behind-the-scenes work, thinking, piecing together different parts, and getting access to sources of all different kinds and making use of the human sources that other countries' intelligence agencies have developed. And they're only going to share that stuff if they trust us to keep it under our hat, basically. And so there's no public awareness of that. It doesn't make headlines, but it's very important in preventing attacks, you know, accounting for the attacks that don't happen. So if that starts to shut down, that's really not good.
So in terms of the information about ISIS planning, evidently this is what it was about, laptop computers that could be turned into bombs and put on an airplane. We are hearing that this came from Israeli intelligence. From what you know, and you know a lot about intelligence, what would have had to have been done to know about a plot, an upcoming plot? Would you have somebody embedded in ISIS? How good is the Israeli intelligence? How long have they been trying to get sources on this?
Well, I wouldn't claim to be an expert on Israel's ability to penetrate ISIS, but generally the Israelis have been quite good at developing intelligence on the threats that they face against Hamas, against Hezbollah, and against Al-Qaeda and various other Syrian actors. So I wouldn't be surprised if they've developed some assets in the Islamic State, and so they may have some human intelligence that we may not have. That said, we also have a lot of technical means. Not as if our ability to combat ISIS was shut down, but we have, from time to time, conducted airstrikes, and in some cases, commando raids or drone strikes, against very specific targets, moving vehicles in some cases on particular highways in Syria, in Iraq. And the intelligence for things like that, partly it comes from signals intelligence, but human intelligence really helps as well if you want to know who's in a particular vehicle and whether there are civilians in it as well, so whether you can attack it or not. And as I say, those things are going to, access to that sort of information from other countries at least, is going to shut down. Another possibility that's almost equally unfortunate is that it may happen that the United States intelligence bureaucracy, sort of below the CIA director level, would start to have qualms about moving information up the pipeline because of uncertainty about how it would be treated and whether it would be closely guarded. And so you might see a watering down and a attenuation of the president's daily intelligence briefing. And so the best information, or the president may not be getting all the information anymore if the bureaucracy starts to withhold it.
And in terms of what the Russians might do with the information that President Trump gave them, how could that be used in a way that would hurt us or would hurt other nations?
I don't know. I'm not so much worried about the Russians in this context, although, well, in this particular context, of this particular information from the Israelis. The broader point, though, remains that if Trump sort of cavalierly shares U.S. intelligence with Russian envoys in the Oval Office, I mean, the United States and Russia have a fairly conflictual relationship on a number of issues. And so that's an item of great concern from an American national security perspective. So that could lead possibly to other, I mean, there could be subsequent episodes of this sort of thing happening that are more related directly to U.S.-Russian relations, intelligence that we have about their missile forces or whatever it might be, something that's really more directly associated with a bilateral relationship. And if we start, if the president starts kind of cavalierly sharing that sort of information with the Russians, then it could enable the Russians to backtrack to how we found out that information. You know, even if he doesn't share sources and methods, sometimes the information itself, you can kind of figure out how that might have been gathered.
And not that we know the answer to this necessarily, or maybe we get an indication from past behavior, but when you heard this news, Professor Kidd, did you immediately think, oh, he's doing that for this reason, fill in the blank, or did you look at it and say, well, I can't understand why he's doing this, but I think we need to speculate as to why in the world he would be doing this?
In terms of the meeting with the Russian
yes.
ambassador? Yeah, I think there's... I think what one can try to be too you shouldn't try to think too deeply in trying to interpret some of Trump's behavior. I think there's some fairly clear guideposts that motivate him. He wants attention. He wants people to think how great he is and how hard he's working and whatnot. I don't think he's a deep strategic thinker. He's concerned about his reputation and about what people say about him, but he's not a deep strategic thinker. I don't think there's any point in looking for Machiavellian plots or ploys or crafty stratagems mm-hmm. out of him. My guess is that in this sense, it was simply from what I've heard, he was trying to make some broad point about how the United States and Russia share interests in counterterrorism, which is certainly true. But, you know, being indiscreet in making that point by revealing the sort of classified information, which was totally unnecessary, but, you know, it goes along with sort of an impulsive personality who doesn't really think very carefully about what's classified, what's not, what should be said in what context and what shouldn't be said, et cetera. So I think there's no point in really trying to micro-analyze it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people in the intelligence community and others are wondering whether or not this president can be trusted with state secrets?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, as I sort of indicated, I think that that's probably a thought that's going on in the lower reaches, lower to middle reaches of the CIA, certainly in other intelligence agencies in the broader intelligence community, not to mention the staff of, say, the State Department, the National Security Council. I mean, I think this Comey memo is going to be the tip of the iceberg in the sense that anybody with any integrity and common sense and actually self-preservation instincts when it comes to future potential prosecution is going to be documenting what's going on and leaving a paper trail right. of things that they've been told to do and the things that they have done or haven't done in response. When they think it gets anywhere close to something that's illegal or obstruction of justice or anything like that. So there's going to be lots of these little things all over the place, mm-hmm. I would think, in a bunch of different agencies. So, I think there's going to be a lot of concern along those lines.
What does it mean for his presidency?
Well, I mean, in terms of, it's extraordinary in the sense that no presidency has gotten off to this rocky a start in modern memory. I mean, presidents usually have some sort of honeymoon when they're popular, they've just been elected, people want to give them a chance. And even with Trump, although it was an extremely divisive election, and people were dead set against him, certainly on the Democratic side, there was some uncertainty amongst Republicans about him, some uneasiness, but they voted for him anyway and thought, well, we should give him a chance. And now that's, we're starting to see that erode on the Republican side. But the thing is, I mean, there's a lot of talk about impeachment or Article 25 mm-hmm. ways of removing Trump from power now. But I think that's all sort of wishful thinking on the part of the Democrats and premature, in a sense, because I think Trump's base is extremely committed to him and won't understand for one second any of these issues that have been raised and certainly won't take them seriously as a reason to impeach Trump, who's just been elected. They'll view it as all of the sources of their information tend to tell them, from Breitbart on down, that this is all a conspiracy, this is a bunch of left-wing Democrats, this is all fake news, this is the deep state that's attempting a coup, and they will believe that 100%. And they are extremely passionate and extremely angry, and they've been primed to believe that, you know, this is an authoritarian state, Obama was a dictator. By some miracle, their guy happened to get in, but now the state is going to overthrow him and reestablish tyranny. I mean, they believe all this stuff very passionately. So it's going to be a major, not just a constitutional crisis, but a major political crisis in this country if there is some move to remove Trump from office.
And do Republicans get an idea of whether or not this they could lose power? It would seem to me as though if they feel that they're really going to suffer huge defeats in the midterms next year, that they might be wanting to distance themselves from Donald Trump. Does it take that for them to break ranks with the base of the Republican Party or not?
Well, that's the problem. Like, for them... For a lot of these congressmen and senators, Trump was more popular than them. And Trump defeated every single challenger in the primaries handily by moving further in the direction of the so-called white nationalism, the conspiracy theorizing, the birtherism, you know, anti-trade, anti-international, anti-Mexican, anti-Chinese. What distinguished him in all of those campaigns is he was willing to go further in all of those directions than any other person, and he won decisively. And so all of those people now have to realize, well, we're the kind of people who basically lost to Trump, right? Trump beat people like us in the primaries. And now we're going to be the ones to go to the public, to our base, and say, you know, go with us. We're going to remove Trump by this extraordinary, extremely rare, you know, process, be it impeachment or Article 25. And trust us, you know, we're doing the right thing because Trump is not qualified to be president. When, again, like 30 to 40% of the population passionately believes that he ought to be president, and that there is a slow-motion coup being implemented by authoritarian minorities, essentially, right, or whatever else they've just read on Breitbart. So I think they're extremely reluctant to do that, literally unless Trump did something incredibly obvious and illegal. Like, he used to joke in the campaign that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't hurt his popularity. You know, he would have to be on a film shooting someone on Fifth Avenue for it to even be an issue. Or he would have to start a nuclear war or something like that, right? If he did something like that, then maybe you can move against him. But all of this stuff, everyone who is attuned to history or international relations or constitutional law thinks all of the stuff that's happened is outrageous and obstruction of justice or potentially obstruction of justice. But it is not going to be viewed as such at all outside of Washington.
Well, what you're saying then about the mentality of the American people is rather depressing, that we are primed to believe information that simply is not true, that we don't have a passion for what is truthful.
Yeah, I think that's a very clear implication of the past electoral cycle, right, that we have a very divided electorate that gets their information from diametrically opposite sources, presenting diametrically opposite views of the world, and that I think you have a combination of basically a 30-year process with Fox News and with right-wing talk radio to delegitimize the very notion of a search for objectivity or that journalists ought to be reporting the facts rather than simply presenting an opinion. And so where that has brought us now is that the President of the United States routinely says that the most objective, the most well-staffed, the most heavily researched publications, CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post, those are, they've gone from being called the mainstream media in a pejorative sense, which is what they used to be, to being the fake media.
Right.
That's all he calls it, the fake media. so as to put them on a par with the guy in his bedroom in Ohio who invents the story about ballots being, pre-filled out for Hillary sitting in a warehouse out of a bunch of stock photos and his imagination, and just publishes that on the web, right? So that's what the New York Times is. It's just, some sort of political operative for the Democratic Party. So there is no, and that extends to science as well, of course, right? There's no such thing as science. There's no such thing as objectivity. Scientists are simply left-wing activists, right? That's where we are in this country. Like, 40% of the country believes that.
40% of the country? Or
easily.
Really?
Right? If you look at Trump, you look at Trump's victories in the primaries, right? They were decisive. His victory in the general election, admittedly, he didn't get an absolute majority. But he won decisively in a lot of crucial states. And so, I mean, well, maybe not 40%. Certainly half of the people who bothered to vote in the last electoral cycle are either believing that or willing to go along with that for the sake of whatever else they think they'll get out of it.
We're going to take phone calls. Our guest is Professor Andrew Kidd, Professor of Political Science at UW-Madison. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. To you in a moment on the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls. Jake is our first caller for you in Oshkosh. Hi, Jake.
Hi, good afternoon, Kathleen.
Good afternoon.
There's one part of this story I don't understand. In this meeting at the Oval Office between President Trump and the Russians, prior to that, it's been a well-known fact for decades that the Israeli government and the American government spy agencies interact with each other, share information, et cetera, et cetera. So why and how can this be considered classified?
Professor?
Why is it? It's certainly well known that the United States and Israel have a close alliance. It is, in a sense, well known to say that the United States and Israel share intelligence, although they would probably, I don't know if they might deny that publicly, although nobody would actually believe the denial. But what's classified is not the fact that the United States and Israel share intelligence, but the specific content of the information that Trump relayed in the meeting, which apparently had to do with some sort of ISIS plot or capability vis-a-vis attacks on aircraft that Israel knew about and that Trump was using as to sort of underline the point that, hey, United States, and we in the United States and you in Russia have common interests opposing ISIS and opposing terrorism in general. So we should work together on that. So it's not that we are in that we have a close relationship with Israel, but the specific information that we gleaned from that relationship that is classified.
Thanks, Jake, for your call. Nate in Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Oh, hi. I was going to some extent agree with your guest in that I think the Republicans have spent years building up a great big echo chamber, and that Trump said, hey, I can BS better than anybody else, and sort of use that to take a hold of it, and look where it got him. On the flip side, though, I know he's being a little dour for, but I think that there are enough people, certainly outside Washington, D.C. itself, that are not easy with Trump being president, that he is utterly immune. Not only did he not win the popular vote, but I think that there were enough swing voters who maybe were uninspired by Hillary that they either stayed home or tried something and are getting a bad taste, because now I don't think he's really that popular across the country once you get outside of certain groups. And I was going to say about the security thing, I think it's rather hilarious to see all the complaints made about Hillary, now that I mentioned her, and then you turn around with Trump, and the Republicans were trying to, like, find a way to look away.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, yeah, I think that's right. There is this sort of middle group, one could say, that is the swing people who sort of decide the elections, who could have voted either way, and they were not enthusiastic about Hillary for a variety of reasons. And I think a lot of them are having second thoughts about Trump, and so his approval rating is you know below 50%, which is pretty rare for a president at this stage in his first term of office. So I think that's right. The question is that low enough and is that decisive enough that you could actually so the question is, what's the implication of that? And does that mean that his presidency has been irreparably damaged, that he is going to be impeached, that the Republicans are going to try to get rid of him before the midterm elections, or maybe after the midterm elections? And that's where I'm just not so certain about that, because he is such a charismatic figure on the campaign trail, and he was successful where a lot of these folks and people like them were not. So it's kind of an open question as to whether these Republicans think they could actually do that without stirring up a hornet's nest that they can't really control. I mean, that's, I think, what remains to be seen.
Thomas Friedman's column today, I'm wondering if you agree with what he says here, asks this question: are there a few good elected men or women in the Republican Party who will stand up to the president's abuse of power as their predecessors did during Watergate? That question will surely get louder with the report that Trump asked Comey to halt the investigation into the president's former national security advisor. But, Friedman writes, we already know the answer: no.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few people who are critical, certainly, of Trump. I mean, John McCain is one, and there's a couple of others. And there is, you know, there are committees in the Senate that are investigating, and Comey may testify, and he's slated to testify, about what's happened. And so I think a lot of them don't want to, but there's, interestingly, still, I think, some sense in which they feel obligated to listen to this information. And so that may be enough to bring some of it out. I do think there'll be more. I mean, some of it obviously will be done by journalists, before. But as I think your previous guest pointed out, right, the big difference between now and Watergate is that the Democrats controlled Congress in Watergate. So you had the opposition party. And when the president and the Congress are held by opposing parties, then, of course, there's lots of investigations. One might say even too much in the way of investigation. But when they're controlled by the same party, the eagerness for investigation trails off remarkably. So we'll have to see what's going to happen there.
Well, and yet he doesn't have a great relationship with lots and lots of members of Congress, Republican members. And at this point, all that they want to do, they have this golden moment on health care and taxes and education reform and you name it. But they've got a president who's under such a cloud that they're having a hard time advancing on what they've been waiting for years to be able to do.
Yes. Hence Mitch McConnell's plaintive plea for less drama from the White House.
Right.
I think that's right. They would like to get on with what they would like to get on with. Basically tax cuts and the rest of the conservative agenda. And they're finding it, all these distractions from the White House sort of getting in the way and making, filling up the news with unnecessary things and occupying their time in ways that they would otherwise not be doing.
Don't you think some of them are hoping for Mike Pence?
Oh, they would love Mike Pence. I think, like, if they could just wave their magic wand and Trump would go away and Mike Pence would be president, it would be their dream world. So, yeah, but the question is, do they want to go through the process of actually trying to get rid of Trump with the potential for enormous backlash among the base of the Republican Party? So I think that's the question. I mean, again, in the campaign, Trump proved that he had his finger on the pulse of the hardest of the hardcore of the Republican Party, and the traditional conservatives didn't. So for them to come back and say, well, now we're just going to get rid of you because we are the authentic conservatives, and we're going to pursue tax cuts and free trade and, you know, slashing social services, which is nothing. Like, the base was completely unmoved by that. What they were moved by was anti-foreigner stuff, anti-Mexican, build the wall, stick it to the Chinese, and all the rest of it, right? The Trump message. So for them to say, no, the message that got you all excited, we're going to get rid of that messenger, and we're going to go back to our old message that was pursued by, you know, Ted Cruz and all the other people who were running in that primary who were defeated, we're going to go back to their message, right? That's a very difficult sell.
But has he delivered on his message?
Has Trump?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a weird thing. Like, he's abandoned, well, not abandoned. I mean, he's so mercurial. You don't know. He may seem to have abandoned something, and then the next day he goes back to it. But in terms of being confrontational with China, that seems to have been put on hold for a while, essentially because of the North Korean issue, it seems, that he wants to get Chinese cooperation over North Korea and realizes that he can't just stick it to China on all the other issues, the trade and whatnot. Plus, I mean, he was saying a lot of things in the campaign were simply weren't true, i.e. that China is a currency manipulator, which they were several years ago, but which they stopped doing back in 2014. And he was informed of that by his friends from Goldman Sachs once he won the election. So he had to kind of walk back from some of those specific things. But now, yeah, so being tough with the Chinese seems to have taken a second tier to dealing with the North Korean issue. The Mexican issue, like the wall, is the wall going to get built? Is it not going to get built? When will it be funded? It's hard to say. Sort of not in the present budget, but maybe later. So there's sort of some back and forth. Some of the big things that he's done, though, did garner a lot of headlines, even though they weren't successful, right? The ban on travel from the predominantly Muslim countries, right? That was ultimately a failure in terms of being struck down legally, but it was enormously popular with his base, right? From their point of view, there's nothing wrong. The only thing wrong was that activist judges got in the way and blocked this perfectly wonderful policy that he implemented. So in that regard, I think this narrative is building up, which he will certainly stoke and foster with everything at his disposal, that he is being blocked by the establishment, by the, you know, the status quo, by Democrats, by activist judges. So he's fighting for you, but, you know, he needs more time to accomplish the things that he is set out to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Nate, for your call. Mike in Madison, hi.
Hi, just a quick one. How did Putin get to be president? How many people did he kill? I mean, Trump complimented him, basically, for killing. He said, we did do it, too.
Yeah, I mean, Putin was essentially appointed by his predecessor, Boris Yeltsin, handpicked as a successor back in the late 90s. And has he killed people? Well, people speculate that he has had various people assassinated, various journalists, the opposition leader, Boris Nemtsov, a couple years ago. So, yeah, the speculation is that he has had a number of people that he viewed to be politically problematic killed. And yes, Trump said, well, we're not so innocent. We've had a lot of people killed, too. It's not clear what he was referring to, who he was referring to in that regard. Political assassination has not typically been pursued in this country by political parties, thankfully. People who killed, who tried to kill various political leaders from Kennedy to Reagan to Gabby Giffords tended to be unbalanced people. So I'm not sure what that statement was about. That was sort of Trump being Trump.
Thanks very much for the call, Mike. Professor Kidd, we are at the end of the hour. Thank you so much for being with us. Professor Andrew Kidd, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His special areas are international security issues, proliferation, terrorism, trust, and conflict resolution. Thanks so much to Gretchen Brown for producing the hour, and to Colleen Leahy for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, we will, after 1 o'clock, be talking about Wisconsin's need for more teachers, and to deal with the shortage, new programs are cropping up to train teachers from outside the conventional college route. We'll talk about how significant the teacher shortage is in our state. That's hour number one. Hour two, we'll look at environmental policy under President Trump. Tomorrow is the last day of the climate change talks in Germany. We are wondering whether or not the president will follow through on his promise to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Thanks for all of your calls, for participating in the show, and for your messages on Facebook, if there are any. I hope there are. You can always leave messages there. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We like to hear from you. This is the Ideas Network.